Welcome. Thank you so much for tuning in to the third episode of FemWonk. I'm your host, Katie Davey, and today we are going to quite literally wonk out. We're going to talk about the Political Process Financing Act in New Brunswick and an amendment that happened about 2 years ago, which allowed for votes cast for women to be counted as 1.5% in calculating the per vote subsidy. I'm joined by Jordan O'Brien, who at the time of the amendments was the chief of staff to the premier, and he brings some really interesting insight on how this amendment came to be, as well as some innovative ways that he sees parties being able to adapt to new fundraising rules as well, and for parties to take advantage of this amendment and how the per vote subsidy works. I hope you enjoy. I learned a ton. I feel like I say that every episode. So let's just get right into it. Thanks so much for joining us today, Jordan.
Thank you, Katie. It's a pleasure.
So today we're going to chat a bit about the amendments to the Political Process Financing Act in New Brunswick that saw the introduction of basically a 1.5% incentive for votes cast for female candidates. You were pretty instrumental in implementing this. Would you mind just chatting a bit about your experience, kind of to the lead up and where this idea came from?
Yeah, well, the Liberal Party had a few electoral reform related commitments in its 2014 platform, one of which was to look at ways to get underrepresented groups more involved in the political process. I won't get into all the weeds of where we got to where we got, but eventually government appointed a commission on electoral reform to look at a variety of issues that had both been in the Liberal platform and had been raised by other parties, including this commitment about helping underrepresented groups. And the commission recommended some kind of a financial incentive to try to attract more women to elected office. So from there, we had to figure out what that would look like. And there wasn't a lot of science behind it. There was a few examples around the world of how it had been done, most of them quite complex. And it was actually, I think, myself that just threw out one day, well, why don't we just count votes for female candidates at 1.5 times the value of male candidates in determining the share of the subsidy that all parties get after an election. And everybody thought that was a great idea, so off it went into legislation.
Yeah, that's an interesting point you raise about kind of doing a bit of a jurisdictional scan, because it's my understanding that New Brunswick is the only jurisdiction definitely in Canada with this type of, I guess, incentive. But did you get any indication of anywhere else that was doing this really across the world, or was that kind of outside of the scope?
No, it's in the Electoral Reform Commission did look at it, and there's a number of jurisdictions. I don't know how many, but none of them very close to here. I think Bosnia is the closest jurisdiction to Canada that has it. Mostly African countries, actually, that have some kind of mechanism formula to enhance the portion of public financing to parties for electing a number of women. There's one country, I forget which one, that if more than two-thirds of a party's slate is of one gender or the other, they are completely disqualified from receiving any public funding at all. So there's a wide variety of this. I'd say maybe 10 countries, and each one does it kind of their own way. There's no standard.
Oh, that's interesting. Or I guess for folks who don't necessarily know what the impact of these dollars are, my question would be, from your perspective, how much do parties rely on this kind of pot of money each year? And it comes through yearly, is that correct?
Yeah, it's calculated yearly. It's actually paid to the parties quarterly. And the answer to your question is a lot. The smaller parties in particular, but even the larger parties. So for the Liberal Party, it's in the range of $200,000 to $300,000 a year. And the operating budget of the party in a non-election year would be less than $500,000. So it's very significant.
So would you say, or I guess let me rephrase that. I think from my perspective, something that's really interesting about this incentive is that it actually entices parties to be looking to recruit more women because, again, this money goes directly towards the parties. Was there any thought into that process? Like, was the party kind of the lever that you were thinking about, or from your perspective, that the commission would have been thinking about when implementing this idea?
Yeah, I would say, and I don't know that there's any other way, unless you mandate that parties have to have a certain number of candidates of each gender, which is difficult to do in our system because of single member ridings. There's no other way than some kind of a carrot or stick approach to the parties to do it, because there's not any real way to do it by law. Certainly there's great groups like Women for 50% that try to generate some of that interest and lend some support to prospective female candidates, and that's great. But in terms of I don't know of any other tool. If we had some form of PR or dual member ridings, it'd be very easy to say, okay, you must have this many female candidates and the problem would go away. But with single member ridings, that's not very feasible. So it leaves you with this carrot approach. Parties are heavily involved in recruiting candidates. I would say the vast majority of people that get elected were approached to run rather than the other way around. So to incentivize parties to look for women more is a good thing. And I think having been around and involved in candidate recruitment for a few years, it's pretty shocking in 2018, 20, well into the 21st century, how often you hear people that you would think were otherwise fairly intelligent say things like, oh, well, a woman could never get elected in that riding, which is so absurd. Like, women have been elected in every region of this province for decades. But anyway, so there's a lot of built-in old boys club style mentality. And you're looking for the prominent business person or the prominent this or the prominent that. And unfortunately, many of those occupations are male dominated as well. And frankly, it's usually easier to get men to run than women. It's more of a time investment for a party to convince women to run, because women are more likely to be perhaps a little more modest about their abilities than brash men. So I think it's a powerful tool. It's hard to say whether or not it worked. It's difficult to reverse engineer that, but we did elect a record number of women, still way too low, but nonetheless, the needle's moving in the right direction. The number of women elected to the legislature had peaked in the 90s and had been lower than that peak ever since, and now we've finally set a new record. So hopefully it keeps going up from here.
Wow, there's a lot of information there. That's fantastic.
Yeah, sorry, that was a really long answer.
No, that's perfect. I think there's some interesting things to unpack there. I'm going to first start just by talking, I guess, overall about recruiting women to run. You mentioned a few things that I found interesting. One, that oftentimes women kind of automatically have that self-doubt, or, you know, will say, it's not the right time, or I'm not the right person, or have other kind of barriers. And actually, just similarly to what you said there, it's kind of that 80-20 rule, right? You spend 80% of your time kind of recruiting 20% of the candidates, if you think about it in that sense, when you look at recruiting women. So I think that that's a really interesting thing to look at, and hopefully we can maybe examine that a bit further in another episode. You also touched on results. So the one thing that's kind of interesting here is that the incentive, and I've got kind of the breakdown just right here in front of me, but it seems like what ended up happening was the Green Party got a bit more money, the People's Alliance maybe got a bit less, and then the Conservatives and the Liberals kind of stayed fairly in the middle. Because the pot of money doesn't change, it sits around, I think, just under $700,000 to be divided between all parties. Do you think that this incentive would ever really be big enough to kind of take that recruitment to the next level?
I don't know the answer to that. I know that in this instance, people didn't know what they didn't know. And I think, I don't know about other people involved in the Liberal Party or other parties, but I was surprised at how little it changed the needle, because there was not a huge relative difference between the parties. which is good. The Liberals ran the most female candidates they'd ever run, and the Conservatives did as well or very close to their record level. So as a result, their success kind of canceled out, as you described. So I think that the size was almost unimportant in this election because parties just didn't realize how much money they were going to get. They just knew they were going to get more money, and they put in the effort. And in the next election, would parties put in as much effort, knowing that it didn't make a huge difference? I'm not sure. Although it's how parties perform relative to each other. So if a party didn't put in the effort and another party did, then all of a sudden it could mean significantly more money. But I think it's interesting the point that you kind of implicitly raised of whether it should be a separate pot and a dedicated amount of money that could be more effective, I think. The other question is whether the formula is right. Like 1.5 was literally a number just picked out of the air. There wasn't any science behind it, so maybe it should be two or three. I'm not sure. But I think we need to see. And after one round, I don't think it's the time to change it. We should see whether or not it's effective. Again, if the number of women elected increases again in the next election, then I'd say that's excellent. And if it doesn't, then I'd say it should be revisited.
So I think the other piece too, listeners might not know, is that in the last, I guess, kind of fundraising year, union and corporate donations were banned in New Brunswick, and the personal donation was cut in half from 6,000 to 3,000. So when we think about that, there would be more of an incentive as well, just there for parties to do a bit more to recruit women to try to get a bit more of this pot of money. Do you think that am I reaching when I say that?
No, it's parties are having a harder time fundraising just in general. Anyway, there's a lot more competition for charity, if you will, and I don't think a lot of people look upon politics as a worthwhile charity. So it's tough to raise money anyway. And then when you add in the fact that the amount that they can get from individuals is decreased, and that they can no longer get from corporations, which was for whichever party was in government, always how they got almost all of their money. And so it's going to be a transformational time, particularly for the two bigger parties, as they adjust. And they haven't really adjusted yet, I don't think. It was just January 1 of 2018, I believe, that the ban came into effect. So, oh, maybe it was the middle of 2017. But either way, they haven't quite got there yet in terms of how to adjust. And I mean, federally, it was in 2003 or four. And really, the Liberal Party has just in the last couple of years fully adjusted to that change. So any tool that the parties can find to fill in the gap that is created by all those pressures, I would think they would be foolhardy not to take advantage of it.
I actually want to come back to fundraising, but I'm just going to kind of tie up a few final points on the incentive. So you mentioned kind of the folks don't know what they don't know. And I think that's a really interesting point because I think with this policy change, what ended up happening a little bit was one, folks don't generally kind of know necessarily how political parties are funded in the first place. And so to add this level of complexity made it a bit difficult to actually communicate the change. And I think we maybe saw that a little bit by the fact that really there was very little coverage in the media. However, I went to, I think, two different conferences in the last year, one held by Equal Voice and another actually held by Women for 50%. And in both cases, the 1.5 percent incentive change was actually kind of hailed upon as what could become a best practice across the country and worldwide. So, what are your thoughts overall? I know you do have a bit of a background in communications about getting out a message like this that is a bit more complex. I feel like I'm kind of putting you on the spot there with that question. But I think it's so interesting that you have, leaders like it was Elizabeth Weir who mentioned that this was a standard or could become a standard at the Women for 50% conference. So what are your thoughts on just kind of getting out a message that is a bit more complex to kind of, and again, like when we do get this message out, is this a type of message that is going to engage more women to run, or again, is it really targeted towards the parties? I feel like there's a lot there, so I'll kind of let you go with what you want on that answer, but just interested in your thoughts on that.
Well, it's a bit of a weird thing because the audience to which you really need to communicate this message is just five. It's the five parties, because it doesn't really impact the women candidates directly. It just in that it may cause the parties to chase the funding, so therefore to recruit more women candidates. So the impact on women who might run and on the electorate in terms of who they're represented by is indirect. So to communicate this, you don't really need to communicate it very broadly other than for bragging rights purposes, because I think it is pretty good public policy. But it is difficult to communicate complex messages. There's no question, whatever they are. And if I had the solution to that, I would be a very wealthy man. People are having it's harder to communicate now because there's so many channels. And people spend less time on those channels. So 30 years ago, you know, there were, 3-10 channels of communication, and that's where people got their information, whether they liked it or not, and now it's almost infinite. So it's difficult to even figure out the medium to communicate, let alone the message nowadays.
So are you telling me I'm going to have a difficult time promoting this episode?
Possibly. I think that there would be a niche for this particular topic, I think, and you kind of have already found that niche a little bit in those two conferences you described.
The Femwonks.
That's right, the Femwonks, absolutely.
So we'll wrap up here in just a second, but I wanted to just kind of circle back to some points you mentioned on fundraising overall. So I think, although not entirely related, but I do think it's kind of interesting when we consider the removal of union and corporate donations and the cut of personal donations from 6,000 to 3,000. From what I understand, actually, women tend to be kind of the primary donors and families. And so I wonder if now that parties will be a little bit more focused on targeting personal donors and targeting individuals, really to grow their base, I wonder if we'll perhaps see more women overall donating to parties. And that actually might be something interesting to look into, is what the donor base is overall for parties. And if that is skewed, I would have to probably guess that it would be. But maybe that's another interesting thing. If we get more folks, a more diverse population of folks donating to parties, if party kind of, I don't know, you mentioned it earlier, the kind of the backroom folks will be more interested in, I guess, trying to kind of recruit a more diverse background of candidates to reflect the membership and the donor base. I don't know if you have anything to add there. It's just I was thinking that might be interesting as you were chatting.
Yeah, I think what you say makes a lot of sense, and it's something that the party should be looking at. I wasn't aware of that statistic that women are the kind of principal donors and households. That makes sense, and if that's the case, I mean, definitely. I mean, it's hard for a political party to compete with, you know, a children's hospital or a cancer research or whoever else people might be considering for their donors, and that's kind of a paradigm that parties need to figure out. The thing that parties have going for them is the tax credit is far more generous donating to a political party than it is to a normal charity, and a lot of people think that that's probably not right, but it is so, at least for now. So that may help, but in the States, they're not tax deductible at all, and they manage to raise money. So I don't know what the answer is, but certainly parties have some real thinking to do, particularly the centrist parties. The more cause-oriented parties have always done better with smaller donors because they're donating for something that they believe in as a cause, as opposed to the bigger parties are more pragmatic and maybe a little bit more fluid in their policy orientation. It's difficult to make the emotional bond that you need to make with the potential donor to raise money for these centrist parties sometimes.
Well, I've really enjoyed this conversation. I'll just ask maybe if you have any final points you'd like to raise, or any takeaways from the discussion.
Well, just one thing that strikes me, and if the Femwonk tribe that's listening to this is predominantly female, I hope it isn't. But if it is, and either way, if you're listening to this podcast, then you're probably a interested in politics and think about running for office. Chasing female candidates has been kind of a pet issue of mine for most of my time in politics, and it's a tough go. I'm fairly confident in saying that I've never had a conversation with a man about running for office where words like, "Well, I'm not really sure if I'm qualified to be an MLA," has come up. I'm also fairly confident that I've never had a conversation with a woman where that has not come up. So I think, we've elected people from a variety of walks of life, from big time lawyers and doctors to bus drivers and secretarial type people to the legislature. All of them have made a big contribution. Anybody can be a good MLA if their heart is in the right place. So I think if the women in the Femwonk tribe are listening, there's going to be a provincial election sometime soon, presumably, no more than 3.5 years from now. So start getting ready.
I love that. A great call to action to end the episode. And we do have folks listening, I hope. The stats tell me so across the country. So there is a federal election coming up in 2019 and a whole host of provincial elections in the next number of years. So consider running. This can be the first call to action for folks who might need to be asked more than once. We need a whole diverse background of folks. Thanks for leaving us with that call to action. And yeah, I mean, folks can find out more information on a whole host of different, I guess, kind of websites. There's Women for 50% in New Brunswick. There's Equal Voice nationally. And I'm sure every province has a local chapter as well. So I love that. Great call to action. And if folks want to find you, Jordan, where can they reach you?
Well, I'm the principal consultant at Criterion Consulting, which is a boutique firm here in New Brunswick. So criterionconsulting.ca is where you can track me down.
Awesome. Thank you again so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much again for tuning in. You can join the conversation online at Facebook and Twitter at Femwonk. You can also visit our website, femwonk.com, and you can subscribe to this podcast anywhere you get your podcasts.